Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us as we talk about the role of religion. Is it a positive or a negative force? Joining us is Dinesh D'Souza, author of the new book, What's So Great About Christianity? D'Souza is a frequent conservative commentator on news programs and author. He's written about Ronald Reagan as well as other books on controversial topics from a conservative perspective. He's a former White House domestic policy analyst, currently a scholar at the Hoover Institution in Stanford. And joining us, Michael Shermer, frequent Air Talk guest. He talks with us about issues in science, but also, very importantly, shares the skeptical perspective on a variety of issues. He's publisher of Skeptic Magazine and author of Why Darwin Matters, published by Times Books. Michael, great to have you with us. Let's first of all talk about this, the moral issue of whether a person can be consistently moral and have a moral foundation for behavior if a person doesn't believe in God.
Right. Well, my take on this is I come at it a couple of different ways. First of all, if you claim that you do have to believe in God or be religious to be moral, what would you personally do if you decided there wasn't a God or you found out
it could be conclusively proven that there was no God?
And almost everybody without question would say, well, I wouldn't start raping and pillaging and destroying and stealing and lying and so on. Well, why not? My answer is that because we all have a deep ingrained sense of moral emotions. We feel guilt when we do something wrong and we feel pride when we help people and so on. I think that's an evolved moral sentiment that we all have that came long before religion, long before government, long before civilization. That is, a social primate species, we have to get along with one another. So there evolved an in-group morality, that is, be pro-social, altruistic, cooperative with your fellow in-group members. And then, of course, the dark side of the Darwinian model there is that we're also very xenophobic against out-group members. So we tend to be cooperative with in-group, competitive and bellicose and nasty to fellow out-group members.
And then there are also outliers in this, though. I mean, there are people who don't seem to have that same sort of ethical orientation or concern for other people, even though they may be a small subset.
Yeah, it looks like the research shows maybe 1% to 2% of the population are psychopathic. That is, they just have no moral sense. There's no consensus on why that would be. It could be broken homes or no families or just
even
neurological problems, something like that. Yeah, some combination of nature and nurture that causes that. So the extreme cases of people, whether they're religious or not, that go nuts and do goofy things that are just outrageous, those are probably in that 1% to 2%.
Well, let's talk also about the force of religion societally, those who are strong defenders of faith and say that it helps lead to enlightened ideals, to the evolution of society that couldn't happen otherwise. And we'll hear in a couple minutes from Dinesh D'Souza in more detail about that. But, you know, if there were no such thing as belief in God, could you have the societal advancements that we've enjoyed?
Yeah. I like these big questions because they're fun to discuss, although is religion good or bad is sort of like libertarians talking about, is government good or bad? Well, you know, government is good when it does good and bad when it does bad, and the same applies to religion. Religion does all sorts of wonderful things, as we saw with Katrina, the disaster Katrina. It was mostly religious organizations that helped. And to liberals who say, well, we don't need religion, we have government that does that. Yeah, well, that was a classic case of how they don't do that very well. So yes, of course, there's all sorts of research that shows all the good things that religion does. But historically, of course, it's done many bad things. And so you have to take particular instances of when it does good or when it does bad and look at those individually. I think obviously lots of people who are not religious at all do all sorts of wonderful things. And so you can stack the deck either way. And that's the problem with sort of asking the question and then asking a believer and a non-believer to debate it. We're sort of forced to tick off all the good things on one side and all the bad things on the other side and then weigh the balance, I suppose.
Well, is religion then, in a sense, neither good nor bad in your view? It all depends on people and how they're behaving within the religious system.
Yes, and if we take the long perspective, I think In human evolution, when these small bands and tribes began to coalesce into chiefdoms and states 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, all the informal means of behavior control and group enforcement of the rules of getting along and conflict resolution and so on began to break down because if you know everybody and everybody's related to one another or knows one another pretty well, those informal means work well. Once you get up into the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, you need codified rules, and that gave rise to government and religion. So to my fellow atheists who say, boy, imagine no religion, you know, there'd be no 9/11, no this or that or the other, I don't think so. We are by nature fairly tribal because that's how we evolved. And so if we didn't divide each other up by religions and kill each other over religions, we'd simply do it over other means. It's land grabbing. It's classic sort of political hegemony and so on. And religion is just one of many reasons or many criteria people use to, again, back to that in-group, out-group, to divide people up into those. And it's just religion has a long bad track record of that because it's been around for 4,000 years. But even if you took it out of the picture, people kill each other over other things as well.
Michael Shermer with us, joining us on Air Talk, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, Dinesh D'Souza, scheduled to join us very shortly, author of What's So Great About Christianity. It's published by Regnery. I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener where you come down on this. Do you think that we as a society and culture are better off as a result of belief in God, as a result of religion, of Christianity specifically? We're at 866-893-KPC. 866-893-5722. Does religion matter in how we behave as human beings? So you say if there had been no such thing as religion, we'd still be finding these ways to organize and have in-group and out-groups. So again, do you think religion therefore matters in how we've evolved, or it's just that's the particular form in which we have historically separated
people? I think it's one of the most powerful ones. I think culture is so rich and complex and intertwined that it's really hard to do the counterfactual history and say what if there were no government or no religion or no this or that. It's next to impossible. So yes, of course, it's an incredibly powerful force culturally. I think a good current example instead of historical one where I think religion is a good example of how religion operates in a cultural context would be the whole issue of gay rights, homosexuality, gay marriage, this sort of thing. I think Christians are largely behind the eight ball on this one. I think they're missing it. And I mark my words, this is my prediction of what in 10, 20 years from now, when you and I are old and still having these intelligent conversations, hopefully, we'll look back on this. And what will happen is that Christians who are citing certain passages in the Bible, there's only a couple, the classic one in Leviticus, a man shall not lie with another man, that sort of thing. And there's a few others. But basically, that's it. And it's tucked in there amongst other passages about stoning to death disobedient children and adulterous wives and not having sex with animals and, you know, these sort of archaic Bronze Age rules that we've largely moved beyond. Why pick the homosexuality one? Well, because it's a very American sensitive subject. And so what will happen is that gays will get rights. This whole marriage thing, it'll blow over in 10 or 20 years and it'll be a non-subject. And just like other groups, Jews, blacks, and women over the last century that have earned their civil liberty, so will gays. And then what will happen is religious people will go back into the historical record, say in the 1990s and early 2000s, and find the handful of religious leaders who were brave enough to stand up and say, no, gays should be treated just like everybody else. God loves them like he loves Jews and women and blacks and so on. And everybody will incorporate it. And the effect is that in-group is getting larger and larger over the last 500 years since the Enlightenment. There's just more people being included as a member of the in-group, which makes it harder to persecute them. And so religion is a force for pushing that along. Sometimes it leads it. Sometimes it's behind it. In this particular issue, I think religion is behind the eight ball on the homosexuality thing, but that will change.
Michael Shermer with us on Air Talk, and now arriving at studio KPBS in San Diego is Dinesh D'Souza, author of What's So Great About Christianity. Dinesh, thanks for joining us again. Good to have you with us on Air Talk.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks. Well, I'll let you lay out your thesis in broad form. What is the contribution that you think Christianity has made to Western civilization?
Well, I think that if you make a list of all the values that even secular people cherish, the idea of the individual, the concept of descent, the notion of science as an autonomous enterprise, equal dignity for women, the abolition of slavery, compassion as a social value. You see that many of these values, in fact, all the ones I just outlined, came into the world because of Christianity. We don't see these values very prominent in other cultures, and they certainly weren't prominent in ancient Greece and Rome prior to Christianity. So I think that Christianity has done a lot to, in a sense, introduce the values and institutions that even secular people cherish.
And you think that if there had not been Christianity, those values would not have been introduced?
Right. Take, for example, the idea of compassion. When I debated Christopher Hitchens recently in New York City, he argued, well, I can be compassionate just like you. We don't need God to be compassionate. If there's a famine in Africa, you can write a check, I can write a check. And I said, yes, but, you know, if either of us grew up in China, we wouldn't be writing checks even if we came from affluent families, because we would be influenced by the Chinese idea that the tears of strangers are only water. We are the product of Western civilization, which is to say Athens and Jerusalem, a civilization formed by Christianity, in which we have this idea that even the suffering of the stranger, in a sense, affects me, and I have a moral duty toward it. So even if the atheist doesn't acknowledge it, he or she is standing on a mountain created by Christianity.
Michael?
I think that's half right. I think Christianity has certainly played a role in Western civilization, say, over the last 500 years, towards some of these values. Yes, indeed. I also think there's a strong secular strain coming from the Enlightenment. Say, someone like John Locke, who coming out of a Newtonian system in which they believed in sort of the corpuscular theory of nature, that all things are particles moving around, and therefore humans are a part of nature, and that we have an equal ability to analyze, process these particles that influence our senses, in which we get our simpler ideas, which build in more complex ideas, and so on. That Lockean idea is the blank slate that we think of, that nature plays a very minor role and that we're largely determined by our environment and in our nurture. And therefore, inequalities in society are largely the product of a rigged, unfair system. Therefore, that leads to his idea of a democratic a political system. That all that comes out of this sort of whole Newtonian thing. So regardless of whether you're a Christian or non-Christian, theist or atheist, it doesn't really matter. The idea here is that people should be treated equally because of this the basis of the system itself, that people, if there's unfair injustices, it's because the system is rigged.
We'll continue our conversation with Dinesh D'Souza, author of What's So Great About Christianity, Michael Shermer, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the founder of the Skeptic Society. By the way, the two gentlemen, D'Souza and Shermer, are going to be debating these issues coming up Sunday, December 9th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Caltech's campus in Beckman Auditorium. They're doing it in the big hall. I'm sure it'll get a big crowd. Should be fun. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming is supported by UCLA Live, presenting the Edon Reichel Project. This cross-cultural collective of musicians from Israel's varied communities was a hit in Israel in 2002, envisioning a modern multicultural nation where all voices are heard in songs devoted to love and tolerance. An ambient fusion of traditional folk music set against modern urban grooves and drum loops, representing the cultural melting pot of modern Israel. At Royce Hall, November 15th. Information at uclalive.org.
This is 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. Good morning. I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Traffic continues to be a mess on the 405 near LAX because of an accident early this morning. KPCC's Brian Watt is there with details.
A little before 5 o'clock this morning, a big rig going southbound on the 405 crashed into the center divider just under the Howard Hughes Parkway overpass. The truck caught fire, and one person inside died. The truck was also carrying a crane, so that's made clearing the wreckage complicated. The CHP has closed the carpool lanes and the two lanes next to them in both directions of the 405 as the cleanup and an investigation continue. They've also closed the on-ramps from La Quijera Boulevard, where I'm standing. The northbound 405 lanes are expected to be closed at least until 1 o'clock this afternoon. Brian Watt, 89.3 KPCC.
Also in mid-city, the 10 West past Crenshaw has a three-car fender bender on the right shoulder, and the 10 is slow from the 110, and it will stay slow until National. It's 1121.
Programming is supported by McAdam Cage, publishers of the new novel, Caspian Rain, by Gina B. Nahai. Class, faith, tradition, and family clash in this tale of love in Iran. Caspian Rain, currently an LA Times bestseller, in bookstores now.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be highlighting a wonderful PBS Frontline documentary airing tonight, The Undertaking, which takes us inside a Central Michigan family-operated funeral home. It's been in the family for generations, and it's really about the relationships and the work that's done by Lynch & Sons Funeral Home. That's coming up in the final 20 minutes of Air Talk. But right now, we're speaking with Michael Shermer of the Skeptic Society and Dinesh D'Souza, author of What's So Great About Christianity, his new book published by Regnery. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Dinesh D'Souza, you want to respond to Michael Shermer's points about the Enlightenment and how it extends outside of the realm of Christianity?
Sure. Let me say at the outset that, you know, I wrote my book in part in response to the new atheists out there. Shermer is, I think, both in tone and substance, perhaps the strongest of the opponents, in because he's so sober about it and he's so genial about it. And he does appreciate that Christianity has had a role in the world. Now, I do think that he's half wrong, if I may say so, in calling Locke secular. Locke was shaped, of course, by the Enlightenment, but he was also shaped by Christianity. We see this also with Jefferson. Jefferson, of course, was not an Orthodox believer by any means, but when it came to specifying the source of rights, where do we get this idea that all men are created equal, Jefferson could think of no better and no other source than the Creator. So we see, if we look at history, that yes, one can come up with secular justifications for rights, but there is usually a hidden theological foundation. We see it with slavery. Why is it the case that no man has the right to rule another man without his consent? The short answer is because we are created equal in the eyes of God. There is no evolutionary explanation for why we should treat everybody equally. So this is no surprise that the great anti-slavery movements that began starting in the 17th, really in the 18th century, were first led by the Quakers, then by the evangelical Christians. They were taking a theological insight and giving it a political application.
Dinesh, you know, I'd asked Christopher Hitchens about it when I was interviewing him on his book, God Is Not Great. And his response was, well, yeah, but it was really the Bible itself that laid the foundation for slavery being acceptable to Christians who were slaveholders.
I think that's actually wrong for this reason, and that is that it would be one thing if the Bible invented or started slavery, but slavery has existed since the dawn of mankind. The Chinese had it, the Asian Indians had it. There were slaves in the Americas before Columbus got here. So the Bible came into a world in which slavery was as accepted as the family. It had no defenders because it had no critics. And what the Bible did is it began, one may say, by saying, "Listen, don't enslave fellow Christians." Look, it's not an accident that it is in medieval Christian Europe that slavery withered away and was replaced by serfdom. So what you had is two abolition movements. First, the extinction of slavery within Europe in the Middle Ages, and then the great campaigns against slavery led in the 17th and 18th century, both in Europe and in America, and in both cases led by preachers.
Michael.
Well, I should point out that the very first article published in America that was an abolition of slavery was on March 8, 1775, entitled African Slavery in America by none other than the atheist Thomas Paine. But the freedom-loving atheist, the person who believed that people should be free. And so his source is really quite secular and Enlightenment instead of religious.
But could you have Thomas Paine with those beliefs if he didn't come out of the milieu of dominant Christianity?
Okay, yes. Of course, it's impossible to play the counterfactual and say, let's take Christianity out of the last 1,000 years of history. Well, we can't.
But wasn't Shermer more of a deist than an outright
atheist?
Yeah,
that's right. Jefferson and Paine, these guys are mostly deists.
That's not atheism. I think we tend to say that today. But deism, this idea of a sort of grand author of the universe, becomes a very powerful transcendent grounding for morality. I agree, in Christianity, you go further than that. The idea of a God that answers prayers, intervenes to cause cause miracles and so on, but just very simply the idea of a transcendent God, I think is a necessary foundation for a lot of Western values. The philosopher Nietzsche saw that, and Nietzsche, of course, was an atheist, but he said, listen, if you take away the idea of the transcendent Christian God, many of the other values that have been built up over the centuries will collapse as well. That's the point that Hitchens and others don't see. They think we can keep the values and kill God.
I respond to that by saying that your two-word phrase, transcendent God, just the first word, transcendent. The idea that something transcends me and you and us, our particular American culture, or the humanity in general. And I think that transcendence comes from the fact that as a species, we evolve these moral sentiments that are both good and bad, and that belongs to us as a birthright. We inherit those. The tendency, as I said earlier, within group to be cooperative, pro-social, altruistic, between groups to be xenophobic, nasty, bellicose, and
differentiates
so on.
Us from other animals.
Absolutely. There are no other animals that have a moral sentiment like that. They have sort of these pre-moral tendencies, but nothing like us because we have language and a bigger cortex. So I think in that sense, we can still gain transcendency. And so Dinesh and I can push it all the way back, yes, but where did evolution, the laws of evolution come from? Where did the universe come from? At some point, you do have to make a leap of faith. Either there was a God that started it all and laid out the laws of nature that gave rise to all this stuff, or the question mark just remains. And there you get to a point where we're off the page of science, and it's really just a sort of a personal belief, I think.
Dinesh, you want to quickly respond, then we'll take some listener calls?
Yeah, I think we've seen, you know, in evolutionary biology, some strenuous efforts to account for morality in evolutionary terms, and those have made some headway, but ultimately they've only been able to explain morality as a form, you may say, of extended self-interest. Christianity introduces a radically new idea, which is to say, agape, the idea of charity toward the total stranger, the guy who can benefit you in no way and perhaps doesn't even share your genes at all, except in the sense of belonging to Homo sapiens. So even if you're a secular guy, you can see that this is a very powerful idea, and wouldn't the world be a much better place if we all embraced it?
I think that's true in one of the contributions of Jesus and the Christians, but that there was a precursor for that in the later books of the Old Testament, particularly the Book of Ruth, which is sort of that feminist influence on the early Christians and the later Jews compared to the early books of the Old Testament, which are pretty nasty and brutal. And I think so the Jewish culture by the time of Christ, by the time Jesus was ministering, had already made movements toward being more inclusive of strangers, such that in the early books, love thy neighbor really did mean just your fellow in-group members, and it's okay to rape and pillage those creeps on the other side of the river. By the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, that had already shifted.
Well, I'll let the rabbis answer you on that, Michael, but I think for Christianity, the Old and New Testament have to be seen wedded together and taken as a whole. In some ways, the tribal God of the Old Testament transformed in a universalistic interpretation given by the New Testament, so it's not ultimately God's laws only for the chosen people. And also, I think in some ways deepened and modified in Christ's interpretation, the idea that ultimately holiness is a condition within. It's not simply outward actions. And then all the other radical and I think beautiful teachings of Christ, which is to say, distinguish between the sin and the sinner, forgiveness. Even if I was an atheist, it's hard for me to see how I would not admire this man and see him as being a moral revolutionary that brought something beautiful into the world.
Bradford in Venice, you're on Air Talk with Dinesh D'Souza and Michael Shermer.
Hello, Larry. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. I've always wanted to say that.
All right. You said it. You've said it. You're on record.
I think this is kind of a specious.
Bradford, you there? Well, it was so specious we lost him. We'll see if we can get him back on. Robert in Glendora, welcome to Air Talk.
Hey, I've always wanted to say more rock, less talk.
Go right ahead, Robert.
Yeah, the conversation has kind of gone a different direction. But sort of a question for Dinesh is, you seem to be talking about the concept of a God that supports sort of a Western civic virtue, and that's fine, but I wonder if that undermines the central idea of God as it's known, in the New Testament and Old Testament together. Specifically, you know, I wonder if somebody were to take seriously all of the teachings of Jesus, if it really would support the idea of a Western Enlightenment state, you know, somebody that has no regard for borders, is in a sort of a really, really committed pacifist, doesn't engage in these sort of things that supports the idea of the state. You know, you have the God of the Boy Scouts and the God of Jesus are not exactly the same thing. And if it's a disservice to sort of conflate the two.
Dinesh?
Well, I do think that there has been, particularly in our time, but maybe in every time, a kind of a political appropriation of Christianity. By the way, this doesn't just occur on the right. We see it on the left now. Look at all the Democratic candidates running around with Bibles, you know, as big as their arm. so it happens on both sides. But the deeper point, I think, here is this, and that is that the universalism that he's talking about was there in Christianity from the beginning. You look at something like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which is supposed to specify these great universal rights, the right to dignity, the right to marry and form a family, the right not to be tortured, and so on. Well, look, even though these are posited as universal rights, they are not rights that are actually defended in the cultures and religions of other cultures. They come directly out of Christianity. They are the rights specified in our Western civilization, and they have been given a universal application. But I would argue that that's completely consistent with Christianity, which began in Jewish particularity, but always saw its message as one for the entire world.
I mean, isn't that argument, though, by extension, saying that there are particular cultures in the world that are inherently corrupt, that inherently view other people as inhuman? I mean, are you not indicting other cultures and saying, well, they're not as evolved because they haven't been exposed to Christian values?
Well, I think that the test of this, I mean, I certainly wouldn't deny that I would easily defend the idea that some cultures work better than others. I'm not saying that they are better in some Olympian sense, but they are better at meeting the needs and promoting progress. They're better at creating affluence. They are better ultimately in respecting human equality and human dignity. In fact, the very concepts of human equality and human dignity arise out of Western soil. And we're seeing that voluntarily many cultures in the world are moving in the direction of Western civilization. Now, if you read my books, you know I am no uncritical champion of Western civilization. I think that there are excesses and even depravities in Western culture that need to be opposed. But I think they are best opposed in the name of Christianity, not in the name of anything else.
What about Robert's point that the Christianity as practiced is really removed from the Christianity of the pure message that Jesus gives in the Bible, and that if Christianity was really to be practiced according to the revolutionary words of Jesus himself, that it wouldn't much appear like the Western civilization of today?
Well, I agree partly in this sense, that I do think that we have become deadened or accustomed to the Bible, to Christ. We tend not to see the novelty, the originality, the force of his insights and his challenges. But on the other hand, when people go around in a blithe way saying, you know, what would Jesus do? The problem is we can't be like Jesus. Remember, for Christians, Jesus is a part of the divinity. Jesus did miracles. He founded a religion. So should I imitate Jesus by doing miracles and founding a religion of my own? Of course not. We are supposed to be like Jesus in a different sense than Jesus was, if you know what I mean. This is a point Gary Wills makes in one of his books. I also want to say that my book, What's So Great About Christianity, we've been talking about one dimension, the impact on Western civilization, but I do believe the Bible as a whole. I do defend in a very full-throated way theism in general and Christianity in particular, and I do attempt to answer, by the way, using not revelation or biblical quotes, but using reason and evidence and skepticism and science, the arguments of people like Hitchens and Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and the others.
All right. Well, and let's take a moment to talk about some of those. I mean, what, from a scientific perspective, how do you think Christianity is aligned with the latest findings of science?
Well, I think that the great discoveries of the last 100 years, and in particular two, first the notion that the universe had a beginning, with its stunning implication that not only did matter have a beginning, but space and time, and indeed all the laws of physics, had a beginning. In other words, once upon a time, there was no time. Now, Christianity has been saying this for 2,000 years, that God created time along with the universe. And the point is that the Christians didn't come up with this idea to force an agreement between theology and science. the Christians said, God told us this. This is what the Bible writer said. And over time, science has progressively come to agree with this. The second point is that I think it's rather remarkable that scientists in the past several decades have noticed that the laws of the universe operate kind of like 100 different dials, with each with very precise parameters. And if you change any of these dials, even a very little bit, you discover that we get no universe, at least no universe that we would recognize, and no life. So the universe appears to be, in a rather mysterious way, fine-tuned for life. If you listen to the atheists like Dawkins and so on, they give absolutely preposterous explanations for this, which take far more faith to believe than to believe simply that a creator did it.
Michael Shermer.
Well, science describes the world and the universe as it actually is, as best we can at any given moment, and religions and all other forms of knowledge then just shape themselves along those lines as time goes on. This is very, very typical in the history of science. And so to go back a little bit, I mean, although Christianity played some role in the history of science in the sense particularly of scholarship and the scholastics and Thomas Aquinas and the idea of being reasonable and logical and rational in how you derive conclusions, that is part of science, but it's only part of science. Ultimately, what gives rise to science as we think of it today is empiricism, that actually the way to ultimately test something. And so although it's true that the Galileo story has often been used by atheists to say that that was just the church squelching some true knowledge, of course, that wasn't that way at all. But on the other hand, Galileo's point was at some point, the authority of the church or any secular source, either Jerusalem or Athens, has to fall or has to follow what is actually in nature. So, for example, when Vesalius first began cutting open bodies, he was challenging the Greek physician, the ancient Greek physician Galen, who simply deduced that the body should be structured a certain way, including the fact that blood must flow across the major septum in the heart. And when he dissected it, there were no holes in the septum. And he said, well, okay, so Aristotle and those guys are wrong. So science is not a force against the authority of the church. It's against any authority that isn't based on some empirical evidence. So whether the universe turns out to be old or new whatever, yeah. Religion's beside the point.
Dinesh, real quickly, we got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, there's no contradiction here. If you go to other cultures, you discover in Hinduism and Buddhism that all of reality is an illusion. In Islam, you have the idea that God intervenes to change the universe at every second. It's only in Christianity that we have this idea of the lawful universe, a universe that's rational, that obeys the laws of mathematics. Science, even today, is based on that faith-based proposition.
Dinesh D'Souza is author of What's So Great About Christianity. For more information on the book, you can visit his website, DineshD'Souza.com. Michael Shermer with us. His latest book is titled Why Darwin Matters, published by Times Books. He's the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and joins us regularly to talk about the top science stories. And this debate and conversation will be continued at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium Sunday afternoon, December 9th at 2 o'clock. It's going to be a big event. Both of the speakers will be signing copies of their books, respectively, after the debate. I don't know if they'll be wearing actual robes as they come out of corners and go at it. But Dinesh D'Souza joining us from sister NPR station KPBS San Diego. Michael Shermer with us here in Southern California. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming on KPCC is supported by Cedars-Sinai. Obesity is a complex chronic disease. The Cedars-Sinai Center for Weight Loss performs surgery and offers a lifetime of comprehensive care to help their patients keep the weight off. It's your health, your choice, your call. You can make an appointment with a specialist at the Cedars-Sinai Center for Weight Loss at 800-CEDARS-1, or you can visit them online. Cedars-Sinai, leading the quest for health.
Programming on KPCC is supported by the Carpenter Center at California State University, Long Beach, presenting Valerie Plame Wilson on November 5th. The outed former CIA operative discusses the events that ended her CIA career, jeopardized her life, and propelled her into the center of political controversy. Tickets to the lecture and book signing with Valerie Plame Wilson online at carpenterarts.org. Utility rates could go up in L.A. The L.A. Department of Water and Power wants to charge more starting in January. February. L.A. City Council would have to approve the hike, and one of its committees is scheduled to consider that today. Council President Eric Garcetti is vice chair of the Energy and Environment Committee. He says the DWP needs to assure the council it'll fix aging infrastructure, hire more new operators, and communicate with customers more reliably during power outages.
I don't believe that we should flip a switch on the rate increases until we have confidence that these changes can be implemented by the senior management at the department.
The proposed rate increases would lift base power rates by almost 9% during the next 2 years. It would be the first rate hike in 15 years. Taking a look at traffic, still that Sigalert and Boyle Heights on the 5 South at Cesar Chavez. The right lane's blocked by a stalled big rig leaking fuel. Traffic is backed up from Los Feliz. It's 11:41 at KPCC.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I want to highly recommend a PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS stations around the country, including KCET in Southern California. The Undertaking takes us inside the family-operated funeral home Lynch and Sons in the small central Michigan town of Milford. Now, Thomas Lynch, who was a writer and poet as well as undertaker, is the funeral director of Lynch and Sons. He joined me more than a decade ago to talk about his wonderful book, The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade. For Thomas Lynch is a gifted writer as well as someone who clearly is a beloved figure in Milford, Michigan. And finally, after years of coaxing, Tom Lynch and his family members allowed cameras for Frontline to go inside the funeral home and to, over a period of time, tell the stories of family members going through the process of preparing for the deaths of loved ones, through the selection process of caskets or what kind of burial or cremation would occur, and then the aftermath of that. Joining us is Thomas Lynch from Lynch and Sons in Milford, Michigan, author of the wonderful book, The Undertaking, and Karen O'Connor, who is the co-producer with Miri Novosky of the PBS Frontline documentary, The Undertaking. Karen and Tom, thank you both for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Nice
Thanks.
To hear your voice.
Thank you. Karen, let me start with you. I know that this is something you and your producing partner have wanted to do for a very long time. Tom finally allowed cameras to come in. This is a remarkable film. I was in tears for much of it. I was so moved by it. But tell us the process of getting it made.
Well, as you know, Tom is a first-rate writer, so we knew if we were going to do this film at all, he was the person and his was the family that we wanted to work with. It seemed to us just a constellation of right forces. The stars aligned in such a way that it seemed in every way to be the right team to tackle this. So we were fortunate. Tom decided to, with his family, that with us, with our team and with Frontline, it might be the right time in his life as well to make an exception and to give this a chance. And happily for us all, I think it turned out to be the film that does us all proud.
Tom, you must have been very happy with the final result, with as much trepidation as you might have had about cameras coming in. I mean, this is a powerful film.
Well, thank you very much. I am proud of Karen and Mary's work. I never had any trepidation about their part of it, you know, because the canon of their work on difficult subjects is substantial now, and I'd watched it over the years accumulating, such a powerful catalog of really fine films. So it was really just a matter of thinking, well, if the best documentary filmmakers in the country, along with David Fanning's Frontline, couldn't tell this story correctly, no one could. So I thought, well, it's time to give it a go.
The family members who were included are extremely well-spoken and do a wonderful job of giving voice to what they're going through in this difficult period in their lives. Hear from the film, The Undertaking, airing tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS stations nationally. We have the young couple, Anthony and Nevada Verino. They're in their early 30s. And they came to Lynch and Sons to talk about the funeral plans for their only child, Anthony, who was born in 2004 with a rare genetic syndrome known as CFC. And they knew that their boy was going to be losing his fight for life in not too long a period of time. In this selection from the film, Nevada Verino, the mother, talks about why making these plans is so significant.
When we're planning ahead, it might even be in some ways a survival mechanism, because for us it gives us like steps and procedures of how to do something.
It's not uncomfortable for the baby.
I don't think we can really imagine how we'll feel when he's gone. I've spent 2 years with a very sick baby who, from his birth, has had significant problems and whose prognosis has never been bright. And every time we found something else out from the doctors, it was always like one more thing that was worse. And so even having that whole experience, when I sit and think about the day waking up when he's gone, I can't prepare for that completely, you know. But it gives us steps, things, I guess, traditions or something that we follow that maybe will help us survive and finding a way to honor him.
Karen O'Connor, co-producer of The Undertaking, when you found this couple, Nevada and Anthony Verino, you must have felt that you had struck gold in their ability to give words to what they were going through and their willingness to share it.
We did. When Mary and I first met Nevada and then met and her beautiful boy, her darling boy, baby Anthony, and then her husband, we knew this was a blessing beyond any measure. They're, as you've said, they are remarkable in every way. And so for us, we knew this was exactly what we needed in every way for this film, because Tom and Mary and I talked long and hard also about the fact that we didn't want a single moment of this film to either sensationalize or exploit people in their grief. And so it was important for us that every single moment in this film had context and had some meaning beyond the scene itself. And Nevada and Anthony and every word that's uttered from that from their mouths and from their hearts give that in every step of the way. So yeah, it was just remarkable, and we were very fortunate that they entrusted us with the most intimate details of their life and death of their beautiful boy. So it was a privilege indeed.
I don't know whether everybody's so articulate in Milford, but the people you have in the film, really, it's just you as a filmmaker, you couldn't ask for more. And Tom Lynch, I want to ask you about your town, because are the people that are profiled here representative of your city?
Well, they are. I think Milford's pretty typical of communities across the nation, and Anthony and Nevada Verino are, while they are remarkably articulate, you can understand why. I've always said this is an education, being a funeral director, and I've learned from parents like them. But I'd say, in many ways, in terms of the sort of emotional and spiritual and intellectual register that they have available to them, they draw on all of it, and they instruct all of us. It's a real education.
One of the things I loved, I believe it was one of your sons. This is a family business, multi-generations. And I think we've lost our other caller, Karen O'Connor. Doug, bring her down, please. Thomas Lynch with us on Air Talk. One of the things that your son said was, my friends or my acquaintance always say, oh, yeah, your dad works with the dead. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, my sense is my father works with the living. And I thought that beautifully encapsulated and is really shown in this film.
It's the math of it is convincing. My father used to always say that, for everyone that dies, the dead are outnumbered by the living who care for them. So that's the only people you can serve, are the living. The dead, he would always tell us, are beyond any harm that can be done to them or any good that can be done for them. But you can take care of their people. And I'm glad that my sons have gotten that lesson, too. I don't know how, I never articulated it to them. They seem to have caught it,
Well, and everybody seems to be so in agreement about this being a service that's provided. And yours is an industry that isn't universally highly regarded. There are people who see it as gouging, as taking advantage of people in a time of grief. And yet I was so struck with all the family members, your sons, the nephews, that everybody who's in this business. Is Patrick your brother?
That's right.
That everybody seems to see this as a real calling and a service.
I think that's fairly typical, too. I mean, funeral directors are a fairly easy target, you know. I mean, anytime you mix commerce, business, with, you know, these existential issues like death and grief and love, it just makes for an easy target. And this is the gift that Karen O'Connor and Mary Novatsky have given to the viewing public here, because I mean, we've seen 40 years of sort of the standard, you know, sweeps week sucker punch, you know, and the caricature, the send-up. It's, you know, that's easy to come to, but hard to put yourself in a room with parents like the Verinos, or with the family of Mary Leonard, or David King's father, and to ask difficult questions. And Karen O'Connor did just that in getting these people's trust, letting their lives open up to the camera so the rest of us can have a look inside, you know?
Tom, what did you think of the show or the HBO series 6 Feet Under, which was not about the funeral industry, but that was the backdrop for the family series? What did you think of that?
I have immense respect for Alan Ball, because I think from the first season, the first show, he was determined to change the longstanding conversation about funerals. And, you know, for 40 years, the Midfordian conversation had always been, you know, what are we going to buy? What are we going to spend? How much can we save? It was all about the math of caskets, pretty much, you know. And that's a yawner after a while. But from the very first show, Alan Ball's conversation seemed to be, what are we going to do when someone dies? And I just think that's a deeper and more useful conversation. And I really look for this. I mean, at the end of the day, that was Hollywood, and that was actors pretending to be funeral directors, whereas the film that Karen O'Connor and Mary Novatsky have given us is real families dealing with real grief in real time. And I think in that sense it will change the conversation, not only for the general public, but for funeral directors and cemetery operators and cremationists and hospice workers.
He's a writer, a poet, and a funeral director. Thomas Lynch joining us on Air Talk from the central Michigan town of Milford. He and his fellow family members have operated Lynch and Sons. And tonight's PBS Frontline documentary, The Undertaking, takes you into that funeral home. And by telling the stories of several different family members, you get a sense of the process leading up to the death, the process of dealing with the body itself. What do you do with the vessel? And then the ways in which people cope with their grief. Karen O'Connor is the co-producer with her producing partner Mira Novatsky of The Undertaking. And Tom Lynch, when I talked with you about your book that came out now more than a decade ago, and we focused on, you know, what you do, you made the point that you thought it was so important for people to actually see the body, to make it real, that the vessel is no longer functioning, so to speak. And you know, I was a little skeptical of that. And I have to say, I've been to a number of open casket funerals since you and I talked last time. And I have to say that there is a real power to that experience of actually seeing the body lying in state.
Yeah. Well, Larry, it's this is the basic signature thing about humans. We know we're mortal, and we know that the people we love are mortal, and this is why we pause for death. But the fact of the matter is, we still deal with the idea of death by dealing with the dead themselves. And you know, we're constantly arranging these you know upmarket memorials where the, you know, the finger food is good, the talk is uplifting, the music is life affirming, someone is on hand to declare closure just before the Merlot runs out, and everybody's welcome but the dead guy who's been shuffled off in private to the retort or the grave by some functionary like me. And I keep thinking, what are we missing here? And usually what's missing is the corpse.
Well, and we'd invite the dead guy, but he just can't make it for some reason. So.
You know, and it is true. It's not, and it's interesting when you frame that question. You talk about it being an open casket. It's not about the boxes either.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe you know the culture has responded to, you know, 40 years of, you know, box taxing. You know, but as I've often told, I always tell families here when it comes to picking out the casket. You know, there's nothing here that we'll get you into heaven or keep you out. They're just boxes. Try to get a handle on it. That's what we're doing here. So take advantage of the range of prices there. But it's still not about the box. You know?
Speaking of the box, there's a wonderful scene with I believe it's the niece, if I'm not mistaken, of a woman who has had a stroke.
Yeah.
And she is in doing cabinet shopping. And I can't recall whether it's one of your sons or nephews who's
Sean, your son, who's
showing the casket. And she decides on one that's was a stainless steel
and vacuum.
Yeah, and you could it actually sealed the airtight, keep water out. And I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful piece that she was buying. But this was a case where the aunt had told her that she didn't want any water invading the casket.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of how individualized people's anxieties and concerns are about what happens to the body after death.
Exactly right, Larry. I always tell people, you know, to some people, this notion of a sealed casket is really important. To others, it means nothing at all, and they're both right. You know, there's not a correct way to think about it. But people do have strong feelings about that. I mean, you know, when my parents died, I could care less whether or not they were in, you know, whether they were in, you know, the best vaults available. That wasn't an issue. But it was important to some of my siblings. So, you know, that's why they invented all these different choices, you know.
Well, and we see in the undertaking a direct cremation where a woman who succumbs to lung cancer is cremated in a cardboard box. Those were her wishes. And so, and what I love, though, again, is we see the members of your staff that are there paying tribute to the fact that the body is being incinerated as it is put into the furnace. And that also is a very touching, very moving scene. Tom Lynch, thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk. And as a viewer of this film, The Undertaking, thank you for allowing the cameras to come in and to chronicle what happens where you work.
Well, thank you for your good words, Larry. God bless and keep you.
Thank you. Thomas Lynch of Lynch & Sons. Karen O'Connor, final comment from you as the filmmaker here. What are you hoping that The Undertaking might provide to viewers tonight?
I hope a little of what Tom referred to earlier. I hope we turn the wheel a little bit in terms of the national conversation about the meaning of rituals and mourning in contemporary America, Larry, just to think differently about it, for us to be a little less afraid and to move past those stereotypes that we all talked about earlier, and that would be enough.
All right. I watched this film with my six-year-old son. He asked a lot of questions about death and the nature of death. He actually watched it with me, and it ended up, I wouldn't recommend it necessarily for all six-year-olds, but for him it was actually quite appropriate, I think, and helpful in him better understanding, and certainly I learned things. Thank you, Karen O'Connor. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your time, Larry.
The Undertaking airs tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS stations nationally and KCET in Southern California. It is a PBS Frontline documentary. From all of us at Air Talk, thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC Southern California Public Radio.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.